From Mothman and Nessie to the spirit that haunts your home, welcome to Bob After Dark, a podcast about legends, lore, and the supernatural. So turn your lights down and your volume up and enjoy your trip to the shadows.
Children of the night, and welcome to Bob After Dark, the show that takes you into the shadows and goes and says hello, everything that goes bump in the night. I'm your host with the most that enjoys toast, Bob, and alongside of me, as always, is my ever wonderful, ever vampiric, ever cape wearing heartthrob of Bob After Dark, my friend, my producer, and of course, everybody's favorite, Count Banning himself. Oh, hey there, Count.
Oh, hey there, Bob. Great to be back here. Another episode, another week of Bob After Dark, where the veil is getting thinner.
It's getting thinner. Yep. You are absolutely correct. We are thinning as we speak in the veil between worlds. The wind's got a little bit more of a chill to it, and the pumpkins are out. And
mine melted already.
Your pumpkin melted?
Yeah.
How'd your pumpkin melt?
It was 80 degrees the past couple of days.
Oh, my God. Pumpkins didn't melt.
Well, no.
No.
It was getting there if the weather keeps up like this around here.
Absolutely. How are you doing, Cal Panic?
I'm doing great, Bob.
Quick weekend update for you, and then we have an exciting episode for everybody this week.
Yes, had a great weekend. Kind of a fall-themed. Saw some pumpkins getting launched at a local church here in the region. They had cannon and slingshots slinging pumpkins.
That sounds like fun.
Took part in your hometown festivity of Wiggly Whiting. Got there Saturday night for some of that. Great time out there in the city of Whiting. And you know, it was a nice theme the weekend to get me in kind of in the spirit here. I talk up about me not being in the spirit a lot, but the weather is getting a little chillier. Things are starting to pop up, so I'm getting more into spirit each and every day, Bob.
That's a good place to be, Count Panic.
Yeah. How about you? How was yours?
Oh, not too bad. Saturday night, I worked, I guess you can say. Did some side cleaning, if you will. And then Sunday, I started watching this popular thing on Netflix called Squid Game.
I heard about that.
Oh, my God, it's good. I can't recommend Squid Game enough. Maybe for Bob After TV shows, I'll talk a little bit more about that.
Right.
But I'm in the full-blown spirit, man. I've been working on the TikToks. And, of course, I've been working on a really top-secret big project that I guess we'll talk about later in the show.
All right.
As it's potential life-changing stuff for here on us on the show, and it's been something I've been talking about for a while, and it's gonna be big. So I'll reveal as much as I can tonight and for the live audience, and then when the podcast goes live, that's when the big reveal will be, and then, you know, we'll go from there.
Sure.
So without further ado, Count Panic, because this is the new era of Bob After Dark, and this is, by the way, your weekly show where we talk about legends, lore, and supernatural things that go bump in the night, lights in the sky, weird cryptid stories, and of course, Count Panic's favorite form of jam.
Ooh. Probably grape, traditional grape.
That's my favorite too.
Yeah.
Yep. And over the past couple of weeks, folks, we've had a lot of guests on the show, and I'll explain why here shortly, where we've been doing a lot more guest-heavy things. And of course, October is exorcism month. And last week we had Father Maginot on the show, from the Gary Demon House, and talking a little bit about Catholicism and exorcism. And this week we have a very special guest. This is something when me and Count Panic, we actually had a production meeting, which never happens, by the way.
One every year.
We have maybe one every 6 months where we'll check in with each other and be like, how's the show going? It's going well. I believe it or not, him and I don't talk about the show very, you know, we'll text each other, but there's not like, some people are like, oh, I'm really intensive talking with my producer. I'm like, yeah.
No, no, we just do it.
We just do what we got to do. So we sat down for a production meeting back, I'd say, in August. And we were talking back and forth about what we were going to do for October, because this is our big month. This is our big month for our big numbers, for our viewers, because it's Halloween time.
And debuted in October.
It's exactly it. And actually, 23rd, believe it or not, was our first date. And this is going to be our second anniversary this year. This is like our big show. This is like what we're going to do. And October, obviously, is going to draw the most people. So we have to kind of step up our game a bit. We're a paranormal show weekly. But we have to do something special. So this month, all throughout the month, we are talking about exorcisms and the people that do them. And, we got Father Maginot, and I sat down with Count Panic, and I was like, What other cultures believe in exorcisms? Believe it or not, you know, I'm used to dealing. You hear about Catholicism and you hear about the spiritual side of things, whether that be cleansing with, you know, whatever spiritual crowd. So I sat down, I'm like, is there such a thing as a Jewish exorcism? And I did a quick Google search, and lo and behold, I found this guest right here. And we're going to be talking with him tonight. And this is our honored guest for the evening. And I will let Count Panic introduce.
Well, from the fine state of Texas,
from the fine state of
the big
Texas.
state of Texas, we got Rabbi Jeffrey Dennis on the program here tonight. And I believe he's there on Zoom. Rabbi, are you there?
I am here.
Good evening, Rabbi. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Good evening, and I'm delighted to be with you. It's an exciting time in October to explore the occult and the folkloric and the supernatural and the paranormal, and it's a fun time.
Absolutely. Now, folks, when you type in on Google Jewish exorcisms or Jewish exorcist or whatever, Rabbi's name was the first one that popped up with a long repertoire of knowledge to back up his faith system too. And that is the numero uno reason why we have him here. And I'm so excited that he responded to our message. So, Rabbi, let's start from the very beginning. Who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, career accomplishments, etc.
Well, my name is Jeff Dennis. I'm a long-term rabbi in a small congregation in a north suburb of Dallas, a town with the very, very Texas moniker of Flower Mound. And in addition to being a congregational rabbi, I am an instructor at the University of North Texas in Jewish studies. And my specialty has been folklore, ritual studies, and Jewish esoteric practices. I'm the author of two books. I published the Encyclopedia of Jewish Myth, Magic, and Mysticism. The first edition was published in 2007. I revised it. There was constantly new information I was able to uncover, and I published a revised version about a third bigger in 2015. I've also published a book of translations of a medieval mystical text called Sefer HaBakir, the Book of Brilliance. I've done a variety of articles, essays, and publications along the way.
Sounds like a busy man with a busy brain.
Yeah, my wife gets tired of my busy brain.
So let's talk a little bit more about you before we dive into the faith aspect. All right. So what got you into Count and I were referring back and forth because we both grew up in a different faith background. So a quick idea about the Jewish faith. How does one become a rabbi, and is that the proper term to refer to you as, if you don't mind me asking?
Rabbi is the proper term. After the destruction of the temple 2,000 years ago, when we used to have a priesthood, and we used to have a monarchy, we lost all of that. What came to fill in the spiritual gap of all of that was a group of sages, basically experts on the written oracles of the Torah, who became known as by the name Rav, which means master or teacher. And the coinage rabbi is the English version of that. It means my teacher. And we're basically lay leaders. We're technical experts in Jewish tradition and in Jewish practice. And we fulfill a role parallel to a Protestant minister. We're not equivalent to like a Catholic priest. We used to have a priesthood. We don't have it anymore. So that's what a rabbi is. Most of us actually get university training, and if you're trained in the United States as a rabbi, you may spend some time in Israel, but basically it's a kind of graduate seminary experience. We all get a master's degree, and they keep us for another couple of years, and they give us ordination.
Okay, so Rabbi, another question about yourself, and again, dive into the faith. Why the paranormal with you? Because I'm going to use the term paranormal. It's a very loose term, and I understand there's a lot more
Now,
significance in
it's
your faith.
always hard to find the right term for what
Sure.
we're talking about.
Right.
So the truth of the matter is that I've always been, from my youth, a person who sort of a happy rationalist in many ways. But I recognize that human beings are fundamentally trans-rational think creatures. We're not satisfied with pure objective ideas about the world. We have experiences we can't explain and opinions that we can't justify, and yet we hold on to. The great moment for me was actually in seminary. And one of our central texts that we study, it's a post-biblical text called the Talmud. And we were reading one of the most important tractates or sections of the Talmud called Tractate Brachot, or Blessings. It's about how to pray. And in the midst of one of the passages, there was this wonderful little allusion. The rabbis, the sages of the Talmud, tend to be people who digress a great deal and bring things into a conversation. So we're talking about doing blessings. And then one of the sages pops up and says, angels travel at different speeds. Michael can get there in a single glide or a single flap. Gabriel in two. Elijah takes four. And the angel of death is the slowest, unless there is a plague. And then he's the fastest. And then we read on to another thing. And I held up my hand and I said to my beloved Talmud professor, well, that was really interesting. What's that all about? And his response was, that's not what we're focusing on. We're moving on. And from that moment, I just had to understand what was going on there. And so I've, from that moment on, whenever I run into one of those little asides or bits of arcana in Jewish tradition, I always stop. I have to investigate. I have to understand what's going on.
Rabbi, you and I have a lot more in common than I believe I started this conversation off with. Yeah, it's exactly how it started with me. You hear something like, hey, what's the apocalypse? We're moving on. Oh, come on. That was interesting. Right. So this month in October, we're talking about exorcisms, right? And my biggest question to you before we dive into the specifics, because I'm really excited to pick your brain. Does the Jewish faith believe in exorcisms? And if you do, what malevolent force, I guess, would cause enough torment in order to have said practice of getting rid of said negative energy, I guess?
Okay. Well, so first of all, the thing we have to grapple with is that the great strength of Judaism is we have no pope. And the great weakness of Judaism is we have no pope.
Sure.
And, right. So as a result, actually, we're not really a religion of beliefs so much as of practices. We're not a confessional religion. So you're not obligated to believe much. And as a result, there are many different responses to the question, what is it the Jews believe? And it has varied over centuries, and it's varied in regions, and it's varied between Jewish communities. So I'll begin by saying this. This is what this is my shorthand illustration of this, that before the Enlightenment, Jews were just like everybody else. Everybody else believed in malevolent spirits. Everyone else believed in certain rituals of power that would protect you. Everyone believed in evil spirits that could possess you and these sort of things. And Jews were no different than anybody else. And then we hit the Enlightenment. And what was very important in the Enlightenment was that, unlike the sporadic persecutions that happened to Christians who believe some of these ideas, we pretty much took it on the chin all the time. Jews were accused of being, you know, allies of Satan. We were accused of witchcraft. We poisoned wells. There was a long list of things that we were burdened with because people didn't understand our practices or our customs. So, there seemed to have been a moment in the early 19th century where all the Jews got together and decided, we are going to be the most rational people on the planet.
Sure.
And we all collectively junked all of our more traditional beliefs in favor of science and Western culture and rationalism and mathematics and all that sort of thing. But the fact of the matter is that we have a long and rich history of these paranormal or esoteric beliefs that have become one of my areas of research and interest. So, do you want me to start from the beginning in exorcisms?
Sure. Whatever you're willing to share, Rabbi, you have the floor. I'm just some guy. I'm like the Johnny Carson of the paranormal tonight. You're my guest. I want to hear about what you got to say.
Well, look, if you go all the way back to the book of Genesis, and however you regard the narrative of the Garden of Eden and the creation and all of that, and I happen to think it's a mythological tradition, but it offers some really big ideas. And one of the big ideas is that humans are animated by spirit, by God literally breathes his spirit into the human being. And so right from the very beginning, there is this idea within Judaism that spirits are essential to human life, and that we are spiritually permeable, that spirits can go in and out of us. And you can see this happening in the Hebrew Bible. People are seized by the spirit of prophecy, the spirit of wisdom, all these terms. And they seem very metaphoric to us in the modern era, but there's a good case to be made that the people who are writing the Bible and thinking about these understood these spirits in a very, very concrete kind of way. They really thought that there were these powers that passed in and out of us. And including that is the idea that there could be an evil spirit. The most famous incident of this happens to King Saul in the book of Samuel, the first book of Samuel. Saul is seized by an evil spirit. That's what it says. And essentially, unable to come up with any other solution, his courtiers bring in David, who is known for his ability to sing and to perform. And he seems to, via music, exorcise this evil spirit from his king. I think you can almost see what's going on with the term that we use to this day to refer to a great musical composition. We talk about inspiration.
Yeah.
That it's like a spirit of music or a muse seizes us. And apparently David had this capacity, and that this spirit of music or inspiration was able to overcome the evil spirit in Saul. Now, there are not a lot of other incidents like this in the Hebrew Bible. However, once we get past the Hebrew Bible, you alluded to the Apocrypha and the Apocalypse and a lot of post-biblical Jewish writings, we start seeing a lot more of this idea of malevolent spirits that can adversely affect us. Actually, a pretty interesting example, because it comes from a period where we don't have a lot of other Jewish records, is the Gospels. The Gospels are reporting on a Jewish community in the first half of the first century, and we don't have a lot of other literature from that time period to look at, to understand. However, what we do have recently added since 1947 is the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were probably composed during roughly that time, and we see examples of things like we have anti-demonic psalms. And these psalms, apparently, while there's no explanation for how they were used, they were probably used in some kind of ritual performance for the purposes of driving off evil spirits. So we see right from the first century, with roots going all the way back to the Hebrew Bible, this idea that we can be possessed or filled with either benevolent spirits or negative or harmful spirits.
Sure.
These ideas evolve over time, and we'll continue to talk about that as we go. Is that enough basis?
That's a good starting point. So in layman's terms, Rabbi, if you don't mind me saying, David was able to sing some karaoke and was able to inspire some muse and was able to push something out negative.
That's right.
That's wonderful. You know, and it's in other culture and other faith, when we look at what an exorcism is or trying to push it out, there's a lot of, you know, let's burn some sage. We're going to cut up an orange. We're going to ring a bell, or we're going to start praying at it. You guys sung at it. That's great.
Right. So what happens is that as time progresses, we move from the ancient world, where exorcisms, to the degree we know anything about them, consist of reciting psalms, singing psalms, singing exorcisms, and maybe sometimes the use of fumigants or roots.
Yeah.
There is reference in Josephus about the use of roots. Mostly Jewish exorcisms seem to be verbal and sometimes musical.
Yeah.
And then as time progresses, we start developing overlapping practices with our neighbors. So if Christians are using sulfur or fumigants to drive out a spirit, we start using incense or fumigants in order to do the same thing.
Sure.
And different evolutions. Now, there are some distinctively Jewish things going on, no matter what time period you're talking about, but that varies from time to time.
That's very interesting. Now, Rabbi, you guys, in the modern age, the Jewish culture, you say, is more rational now, correct?
It's much more.
So in today's day, you don't have somebody, and again, excuse my terminology and pardon my ignorance, somebody's probably not going to temple and saying, Rabbi, I'm feeling as if something's attached to me. It's probably more of like, I'm feeling maybe more, I don't know, what's more modern these days?
So, you know, we tend to frame our negative internal experiences in terms of psychology and medicine.
Sure.
And that being said, some people find that does not resolve their issues. So a person may come to me occasionally. It does happen. I've dealt with this, either living with a kind of terror or dread that has overcome them, or they may feel like the space in which they live is affected by a negative force, a negative energy, a negative presence. So I don't dismiss that out of hand.
Okay.
Because even though I'm definitely a child of the Enlightenment, I also understand that human beings, our experiences transcend pure rationalism. And I think that rituals have power. I don't know exactly whether that power is psychological, whether it, it affects something that is authentically a spirit. I can't say that with any certainty, but I do know that some rituals help. And as a result, I've used rituals to help people overcome those kinds of things, night dreads and feelings like they're haunted, or in one case, a person who does a lot of work with the dying felt like there was a residual presence from the people who had died, and he needed to deal with that. So I came up with something to help him deal with that.
May I ask, is there when you're presented something like this, especially with the residuals, or if somebody feels like they're haunted, is there a traditional thing that you go back to, or is it more, because I know when we talked to the Catholicism priest last week, they have like something set in stone. Is it more like that for you, or is it like, I'm going to come up with this on the fly, what's going to work for this case, etc.?
So Roman Catholicism has this thing, I think it's called the Ritual Romani, or the Roman Ritual. Right. And it's very very established and very liturgical.
Yes, sir.
You know, the power of Christ compels you. You repeat over and over again, this sort of thing. In the records we have, especially really the best records we have of Jewish exorcism, start in the 16th century. where there's a lot of record keeping, and then have continued on to this time where you will still very occasionally encounter a traditional Jewish community that deals with this, there is sort of a toolbox of practices that are used, and it will vary from circumstances to circumstances. So it's not set in stone. There are certain things that we too tend to go back to again and again. The most famous psalm, sometimes called the anti-demonic psalm, is Psalm 91, which talks about protecting you from terrors at night and arrows at day. And there's a whole series of rhetorical statements about threats and how God will deliver us from that. And that appears in many, many Jewish exorcism rituals that are recorded in the past, but there's also the use of certain instruments, the most common being the shofar or a ram's horn, which is sounded repeatedly. Sometimes there are ritual objects used. It really, it varies based on region and custom, but sure. It's like I said, it's a little bit more like a little of this, a little of that. I like to call it the toolbox.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. So it's kind of mixing some stuff together, what's going to work in this circumstance. It's not
right.
Set in stone. That's brilliant. I appreciate that, because even when I'm in my practices, it's not the same thing every time. That's brilliant. I like that. Mm-hmm. In your experience, in your path that you follow, have you ever performed what I would consider an exorcism, or my fans would consider an exorcism? Have you ever duked it out with the forces of evil, Rabbi?
Not in the sense that I was confronted by nothing quite like the Exorcist.
Sure.
Or anything like that. There's actually a couple of wonderful films that have come out recently that have given us examples of visual examples of Jewish exorcisms. There's a 2018 movie called The Golem, where there is an attempt to exorcise a artificial creature that has been created and is now out of control. And there is another moment in a movie called The Vigil, in which a young man who is sitting watching over a dead body, which is a Jewish custom. We do not leave the dead alone. We always make sure they have company. He ends up performing a ritual to remove what the film identifies as a mazik, an imp or an evil spirit. And so there's actually a couple of visual representations of Jewish exorcisms that have appeared in this century. But most of our records are just written reports.
Sure.
Something amazing happened in Damascus and I was the witness to it, or something like that.
Sure. Go on. Sorry.
Back to your central question. Have I ever confronted a evil spirit? No. What I'm doing, I feel like I do, is to the limited degree I've done this, and I haven't done very many, is that I try to address the anxiety and the issue facing the individual to help them overcome it and help them reassure them that there are positive spiritual forces on their behalf. So nobody's head is turning around on nobody's vomiting pea soup.
I was going to ask you about the pea soup. Nobody's got some soup.
No. And quite honestly, I'm very, very picky, because I do believe in psychology and I do believe in medicine. So I get calls periodically from someone in some part of the United States that did what you did. They look up exorcism and they find my name. And so they contact me and they'll say, I really need an exorcism. And after listening to them for a while, I will say, well, look, I'll consider doing a ritual to help you. But before we do, are you under a physician's care? And then they become very guarded and suspicious. And I say, look, I want you to be under a physician's care. I want you to be under a psychologist's care. And if they will write me a letter saying that they think performing a ritual could be of benefit for you and won't be of harm to you, I'm ready to do that for you. And I'd say 80% of the time the answer is, oh, you're one of those. And they'll hang up on me. So, you know, I want to make sure that what I'm doing is therapeutic and not harmful. And sure. I certainly don't want to undermine the very, very powerful modern tools of medicine and psychology that we have that help so many people.
Is that, would you say that's pretty common amongst the your fellow colleagues in rabbihood? If I, again, pardon my ignorance on the term.
Some of my colleagues think this is nuts.
Sure.
they're not interested in being involved in that at all. But I have some who are. If you go into the very traditional Jewish community, you will find dyed-in-the-wool exorcists. And they have very elaborate beliefs about what they're dealing with. And that's become more and more rare. I don't know. For this to be real, you have to have a community that supports the idea.
Sure.
And most modern Jewish communities don't. So, again, I can't say exactly what I'm doing other than I believe that ritual helps people.
Sure. So, Compagnic, do you have any questions for Rabbi before I get into the next round of questions?
I'm learning so much here, Bob. You know, and I think we got a phone call. You want to do it?
Yeah, let's do it. Well, Father, or I'm sorry, Rabbi, we're taking a call real quick live. We'll take it and we'll see if they have any questions for you. Is that okay?
Sure.
Absolutely. You're on the air, caller.
Hey, Rabbi. Good evening. How are you?
I am well, thank God. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Very interesting comments. I also thank you, as I did the Catholic priest last week, for coming on the air and sharing your version of the exorcism as far as the Jewish faith is concerned. A question I was going to ask, you just kind of answered it for me.
Okay.
When I asked this to the Catholic priest last week, and that was, is there a process as far as performing an exorcism? And he definitely said, well, you know, they just don't, like you just alluded to, run out there and because somebody wants, you know, somebody has demons or whatever in their lives, they do have a process where they, I guess, go through an interview with the family or with the person and. Right. Like you hit the nail on the head, where to make sure that they're not medically or psychologically or some type of.
Sure. I mean, there are so many phenomena that affect the human brain that are actually physiological. And, okay. You know, we want to eliminate or rule out those things that are causing people this tremendous psychic distress.
So you don't quickly, as he alluded to as well, run out there and perform whatever ritual you have to.
There is a guy. I think his name is Bob Larson, and he's a Protestant minister. He used to publish books, but now he's got this gig where he does exorcisms for, I think, like $750 a crack.
I'm in the wrong business.
He even does it on Zoom.
Wow.
Right. And so, you know, you'll run into every conceivable way of thinking about this. It feels a little entrepreneurial to me. But you know what? If he can help people, he helps people. That's great. But yeah, no, I'm very much more in the Catholic tradition that we want to eliminate other possibilities first.
Correct. And as you mentioned, the majority, well, I shouldn't say majority, but a few people do hang up after you ask them, you know, are they under any doctor's physician's care, right? So, I'll let you go and keep on listening. And once again, thank you for coming on the airwaves.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for calling in, John. Appreciate you as always. That was an interesting noise as it was hanging up. Rabbi, Count, you said you had another question or we're going to move on?
No, I was just thinking, I'm learning so much. Because, you know, growing up Catholic, Rabbi, you know, I'm not hip on what's going on in the Jewish community. Although I did find out recently I'm 1% Jewish, thanks to Ancestry.com. But other than that,
1%, that makes all the difference in the world.
I don't know much. So thank you for cluing me in here.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. I was and before I move on to the next step, because these are the next ones are going to be the what I'm going to be really picking your expertise on is the what is out there or what is a part of the beliefs, I guess. I wanted to thank you for sharing these things with us, because I feel like when people think of exorcisms, they think of, you know, either priesthood or they think of spiritual movement, either with you know, whatever person would believe in whatever form of spirituality. I don't think people think of the Jewish faith. I certainly didn't during my studies in the occult, and it's brilliant that I found somebody that's willing to talk about this. And I found it even more fascinating that you're mixing the science aspect into it as well. Mm-hmm. I want you to make sure you're taking care of vessel, as I refer to it, as body. Right. And that's important. That is very important. So I just wanted to thank you again for diving into traditional stuff. That's great.
And this goes back a long way. You know, there's actually, you can see, important Kabbalists who engaged as exorcists in the 16th and 17th century were already, the first question was, is there something medical going on? Now, what they could do medically in the 16th and 17th century was very limited, but they were already cognizant of the idea that, you know, that spiritual distress can often have physiological sources.
Absolutely. Rabbi, we have another caller on the line. Who's on the line, Count?
We've got Rick on the line here.
Hey, Rick, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Rabbi this evening?
Yeah, I do have a question. I was wondering, this is a question that's always troubled me, as to why during exorcisms, capturing EVPs, anything like that, why... at least the clips that I've always seen, why does it always seem to be in English?
Oh, because it's in a movie.
yeah, so it can pertain to everyone. I get that. Okay.
traditional Jewish attempts at exorcism or dealing with the spirit are almost always performed in Hebrew. If the Jewish community is an East European community, you'll often encounter Yiddish as part of that. No, that is more reflective of the performance you're watching. And it's not actually how these things unfold. So I will mention one uniquely Jewish thing in terms of this is the nature of possession. You know, the Catholic tradition is that possession involves an evil spirit, a demon. When it's portrayed in Hollywood, it's something massively, horribly infernal, terrorizing creature, et cetera, et cetera. The most common type of pneumatic or spiritual possession in Jewish tradition and in Jewish records is something called a dibbuk.
We're going to dive into that later.
Well, that's fine. I can hold
sure,
on to
sure,
it.
Sure.
New. We haven't learned this yet. So, and that changes the nature of what we do quite a bit. So, you know, that is a distinctly Jewish feature of it. So go ahead and ask your questions and I'll deal with this responsibly.
Well, In my research, I've come across that language is not the same spiritual realm as it is here in our physical realm, where they like language kind of it's not the same for them. Like all languages are kind of like known.
Well,
I was just wondering why, like, especially like a lot of exorcisms we hear about are like in EVPs are in English, as opposed to I've heard other EVPs in other languages. Now what is it have to do with the observer?
I can't speak to others, but the Jewish understanding is and the mystical tradition of word mysticism in Judaism is the idea that, in effect, the Hebrew alphabet is the periodic table of God's creation. You know, in the Genesis story, God creates the world by means of speech acts. He says, let there be light. He speaks the world into existence. And as a result, in the Jewish esoteric tradition, the Hebrew language itself is considered to be divine. It has an exceptional element to it that no other language has. And as a result, you want to perform this if you're going to behave in a way that God does, B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, you want to use God's language, for lack of a better term, and that's going to have a potency or power that other languages don't. So in my translation of Sefer HaBahir, a big part of it is devoted to precisely the idea of word mysticism, the idea that each letter and each word is a building block of creation. And therefore, the enlightened person, if they understand how these letters function, they are able to tap into God's creative ability. So Hebrew is essential to the any performing any act of power.
Oh, that makes sense. The way the universe was brought into existence, I've heard it referred to as the way someone say has a computer editing software, to where you put in a command this here, that or there, and it makes the color change, makes the light change, whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I guess, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay. I'm always excited when I make sense.
Thank you, Rick, for calling in. We really appreciate it.
Hey, Bob, I just wanted to let you know one more thing.
Absolutely.
I came across a cryptid, cryptid is one of our favorite things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't have the spelling on me right offhand right now, but I came across a YouTube video about this thing called the Mayenin.
Doesn't ring a bell, Rick.
It was new to me. It was new to me too. It's this creature that literally like splits in half at the torso, and it has wings and it has vampiric qualities. And there's one or two videos of it on YouTube that I come across.
That is strange. Compank, you dancing in your free time?
I'm gonna have to look into that, Bob.
It's it's one of those videos that's very grainy.
Sure.
But again, it comes from Filipino folklore, and I think it might be an interesting subject to dive into.
Absolutely, Rick. Do me a favor and post that video up on the Children of the Night page so I can actually have the spelling correct too, and I will look into it.
All right, I'll do that for you. Yeah, there's one video that's really. If it's a fake, it's a pretty creepy looking fake. But anyway,
I'm familiar with the grainy videos. Rick, thank you so much for calling in. We really appreciate it as always.
Have a good one, my friend.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Have a great podcast.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Rabbi. Since we brought it up on the call, this is skipping ahead in my questions a little bit, but this is like, when I first started doing Bob After Dark, this was a popular thing that people would buy online, and people ask me all the time about these things, and you brought it up in the call, so I figured I might as well just bring it up.
Okay.
Dybbuk's and Dybbuk boxes, or the just Dybbuk box? Do you care to talk about it?
Honestly, that seems to be a contrivance of Hollywood. I've never encountered and I've never seen a traditional source that talks about a Dybbuk box or some kind of basically a flask for a genie that keeps the genie contained. That's really not part of Jewish tradition. That's just a device for storytelling in Hollywood film. Wow.
Sure. I appreciate you sharing that, because that comes straight from the source, folks. Because people, you go on eBay, Rabbi, and you can type in Dybbuk box, and you can...
you know, if there's an opportunity to make a little money off of it,
absolutely.
You know, you go through the outdoor markets in Israel, and every other merchant sells amulets. They sell, you know, hamsas and things like that. And it's a cottage industry. And since this Dybbuk box thing was presented in a movie, I can't even remember exactly which movie it was. Of course, they had to find a market for it. It's like Aragorn's sword.
Sure.
You know, once you've seen it in the movie, everybody wants to put Aragorn's sword up on their wall.
Bob, weren't you going to open up one live on the air one time?
I decided against it, but now that I know it's probably bunk, I
do it.
Just do it. Rabbi, can we talk about then what is a Dybbuk? What is this thing that you're supposed to be shoving in a box that I can now buy on eBay for $35?
Well, okay. So a Dybbuk in Jewish tradition, it comes from the Hebrew word to cling, to cleave. And a Dybbuk is a cleaving or clinging spirit. And this is a particular kind of possession, possession by a dead spirit. And it's a tradition that seems to develop sometime in the Middle Ages, that and it grows with the growing Jewish belief in transmigration of the soul, that we go through multiple lives, that our souls have a body of soul work that we have to do before we can reunite with the guf, or return to the essence of God. And therefore, we transmigrate. The problem being that some souls are not able to make that transition for one reason or another. And as a result, the soul is sort of cast adrift. And its usual solution to this crisis, because every soul needs a body, is that they will take possession of someone who is considered vulnerable to this kind of spiritual possession. And so a Dybbuk is a dead spirit taking control of a living person. And this is probably the most common tradition in Jewish spiritual possession and exorcism. And it has been for the last 500 years.
Do you, would you consider, and again, pardon my ignorance, would you consider the Dybbuk to be the big bad of the Jewish faith?
It's not even a big bad. This is the problem. When you've got a soul adrift.
Sure.
It's sick.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
It's a kind of illness. So any Jewish exorcism that deals with the Dybbuk possession is a twofold therapeutic process. You want to liberate the living person from this possessing soul, but you also want to help that Dybbuk move on to the next stage of its existence. So the tradition is that really you're trying to get the Dybbuk out, but you're also trying to give it some kind of resolution that will allow it to go on its way. So it's really, you're treating two patients at once.
Absolutely. Rabbi, we got another caller on the line. Line one, we have Jeff. Jeff, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jeff. What's on your mind tonight?
Well, I had a question. So, and this seems like the perfect person to ask. It's a scholarly question as far as the name of the first son of Jacob is how would you pronounce his name?
The name of the first son of Jacob? You mean
yes.
Reuben?
I'm sorry, maybe I have the wrong son, but the one who, it's a three-lettered name. I don't want to like.
Are you talking about God or Gad?
Yes, exactly. No.
Okay. Right.
Oh my, it's interesting that you would pronounce it that way.
Well, that it is a debate, because one of the things we struggle with is
we're not sure how Hebrew words were pronounced at certain stages in the biblical tradition. The usual modern pronunciation of the vowel for his name now is an ah sound.
Correct.
So it's right. So it's God. But now, yes, go ahead.
I'm guessing that you probably know that, like, the reason I'm asking is, like, from more of like that esoteric kind of idea that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's my understanding that names have meaning.
Sure.
And that he received his name on purpose.
Presumably, like you know, the ancient Israelites and Hebrews were very much like Native Americans. They gave names usually based on some event or natural phenomena at the time of birth. So,
and my understanding of the verse is that it's kinds of, oh, what luck will name him God, right?
Right. So,
and now, I'm sorry to, you know, can you tell me, do you know the history of why he named him that?
Sure. Okay. So, exactly why. So, the explanation for the choice of why the matriarch names him that particular name is that she wants him to have good luck. And the Hebrew word God means fortune or luck or, fortuitousness. Now
I didn't heard a different explanation of that.
Well, I mean, let me go a little bit further. If we go a little bit further back into Canaanite tradition, God is the name of a minor deity.
Correct.
That is a deity of good luck or something like that. So what is the original purpose of this name? You know, the names that our ancestors gave each other, they were not, as a general rule, to be perfectly honest, and the Bible is honest about this, they were usually not pure monotheists. And so they were already, merged into the culture in which they were surrounded. And we have the story of Rachel stealing the teraphim, the little family gods, from Laban's house. Why would she do that? I think she thought they had some kind of power to protect her, and that's why she held on to them. It may be that the matriarch originally intended to invoke the name of this minor deity, or she was just invoking the idea that there is some kind of force.
See, that's where I'm leaning. And like, basically, to me, when you think of the Elohim or the Yahweh who gave us the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. he was very specific about not worshiping other gods.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is now you have it, the most common way of describing him is by using the name of this lesser god. How
well,
funny
you mean,
is that?
You mean like God in English?
God, yeah. I mean, when well, we try to talk about God, the only word we can think of to call him is God.
So be careful here, because what you're focusing on is an assonance. That is that two words in two different languages sound alike.
I understand that, but it's still how it's coming out.
Look at the English word for God comes from the Germanic word for good.
Correct.
And absolutely no connection to the Hebrew term God or fortune, which is an unrelated language, not even in the same language family. One is Indo-European language.
I understand what you're saying.
It's just an accident. It's like saying that, Cain, his Hebrew name is Cain, and he must have been a spicy guy because we've got cayenne pepper, right? there's no connection. There's no semantic connection to these words. Sorry.
Well, I still think it's interesting that we're walking around using the name of another god to describe the one that created all things.
Okay.
I appreciate the phone call, Jeff. We got to move on with the phone call.
I mean, much of my studies in rabbinical school was on language. and its uses and misuses. And you just have to accept sometimes that just because two words sound alike, there's no intrinsic connection between them.
Excellent. Rabbi, we're back to topic at hand here. We appreciated the call. Thank you, Jeff, for calling in. It's I'm sure you were working Rabbi's brain a little bit there, but let's get back
That's
to
all
the,
right.
Talking about the parent. Go on, Rabbi.
It's cool. You know, that there's so many things that we hear, we learn. It turns out the internet is not necessarily a terribly reliable source of information. Who knew?
Now, so we talk about DivX, and I wanted to touch base a little bit about some of the other classic, I guess. I'm gonna use the term paranormal or occulty type figures in your culture base. One of my favorite stories of all time, and believe it or not, is a Jewish mysticism story about the Golem. The Golem is one of my absolute favorite stories. I absolutely love it. It's actually the lost media film from one of the earliest films ever made was the Golem, and I love that. Yeah.
Wagner film from 1915 and 1920. It's an amazing silent film.
Oh, you have good taste, Rabbi. That's
cinephile. I love film.
That's my thing. That's what led me to do this for a living, I guess, in a weird way. But the other than the Golem, and I was hoping you could talk a little bit about the Golem from hearing it from your mouth versus me just reading it online, because that's what I'm really interested in. Other than the Golem, what else is kicking around in the Jewish culture that's kind of spooky, kind of monstery, you know?
Right. I mean, I published a whole book on everything I could find. So, based on one way of reading the Bible, there's the Kisalim, which are kinds of imps that it means basically a fool or a prankster, and that idea exists. We have cosmic monsters.
Oh, that's scary.
The cosmic monsters that are mentioned in the Bible are Leviathan and Behemoth, a sea monster and land monster that in biblical tradition are the reification or personification of chaos. What was existed before the cosmos was formed. And these monsters can have a continued existence in our world, that even though God put the world into a certain kind of order, which is what we see in the book of Genesis, the process has not been completed. When we get to the final day, God says, looks at the world and says, Tov Ma'od. He says that the world is very good. What he doesn't say is the world is perfect. And what is understood by that is that there is still a divine drama of bringing the world into full order, that there are corners of chaos, forces of destruction that still mark our world, and that God and, to a great extent, we are supposed to be working on that, on slaying the chaos monsters. So there's a sort of deep mythological element going on in the Hebrew Bible that actually most modern people don't talk about or want to talk about. As far as most people are concerned, mythology and myth is something that pagans have. And there's no such thing in the monotheistic traditions, but there is. And so there's Leviathan, there's Behemoth, and then the rabbis add, since one is a fish and one is a fish dragon and one is a gigantic land monster, they had to have a bird. And so the rabbis say that there is a king of birds called Ziz.
Ziz,
who is so big that one rabbi on a ship, Rabbi Barbar, is sailing between these giant islands, and he realizes that it's actually the talons of Ziz sitting in the water. This trifold chaos monster tradition exists. In the European Jewish tradition, we encounter vampire-like creatures. We encounter werewolves. Vampires actually make their first appearance much earlier than that in a Greek Jewish text called the Testament of Solomon. And in this, it recounts an incident where a vampiric-like demon or evil spirit is feeding on one of the workers on the temple. And so Solomon has to intervene to save him. And this is the birth of, for example, the Ring of Solomon. That story is first told here. Solomon's ability not only to talk with animals, but to control evil spirits is part of the Testament of Solomon story. And this creature is blood-sucking. It doesn't bite you on the neck. It sucks the blood out of your thumb.
Huh.
Right? But it's a kind of vampire.
Interesting. And Rabbi, I got one more question for you. Now we're going to wrap up kind of the evening here. And sure. you were talking a little bit when we first started talking about like classic exorcisms and possessions in the Jewish faith. And you mentioned the one David had to sing out.
Right.
What is there any other famous written cases of possession or exorcism that you'd like to share on the show tonight?
There's a fantastic book that was published by an Israeli scholar named Matt Goldish that is called Pneumatic Possession in Judaism. And it is basically a translation of all the major reports or recordings of exorcisms that occurred in a period of about 200 years in the 17th and 18th century. There's another wonderful one by another guy named Jeffrey Hyatt called Between Worlds. And what he actually does is he compares the exorcism practices in the Middle East being used by Muslim exorcists with what Jewish exorcists are doing. And it's very enlightening. So there's actually wonderful sources that have been produced in the last 20 years that an English reader can read about Jewish possession and exorcism traditions. And of course, there's my book. They're just entries in my book. These other books are extended analysis and translations. Wonderful stuff.
Speaking of your book, Rabbi, that's how I would like to end our interview. I want you to plug all the things you're working on. I've gotten a lot of people chiming in saying they were big fans of you chatting. So before we get to the plugs, I just want to, if I may pay you a compliment, I think you are absolutely brilliant. You can tell that you are a professor. You're very on point with your stories, and it kept me kept me enthused because, you know, I do this stuff on the daily. So it's really exciting when I have someone teaching me something. It's very good, and I appreciate that. So I just want to start by saying, one, you're brilliant. And
thank you.
Absolutely. Two, what are you got your book, and you got your second edition, you said, of your book.
Right.
And I'll go on. I'll let you plug all your stuff. Plug, plug, plug. Right.
So Sefer HaBahir is out of print, unfortunately. You can get it as a download, but that's it. On the other hand, the Jewish Encyclopedia of Jewish Myth, Magic, and Mysticism is readily available on Amazon. You want the second edition. It's the expanded edition. It's probably in its second or third printing. It's done well. And I designed it as an A through Z easy reference, and it's full of cross references so that if you follow, you've got one idea or one entry you're looking at there, it'll take you to several different rabbit holes you can go down. Jewish learning tends to be nonlinear. It's associative, and I designed the encyclopedia with that in mind. So you can follow different threads, if you want to call it in modern terms, hyperlinks, to different parts of the encyclopedia, and you can learn about one aspect of an idea and then go back and explore other aspects of it and other related traditions. People seem to like it, and I get lots of nice mail and things about it. So I'm very proud of it.
We'll be picking up a copy for ourselves here in the studio after we're done after the show. And then I'm going to send it to you so you can mail it. Well, you can autograph it for me if you'd like.
I will, I'm so easy. I will autograph it. If you put a check in there, I'll autograph that too. Especially if it's made out to me. But any case, no, it's been a pleasure talking to you and to talk with your listeners. Some very interesting questions and ideas presented.
Absolutely.
So I've enjoyed this.
And Rabbi, when the podcast is up, I promise we'll send you over a link where you can listen and share with your fans as well, and your followers, if you will.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Kopanky, anything to say to the rabbi before he gets the hay? Because I'm sure it's getting late.
Well, I had to make sure. It is central time over there, too. So
it is. It's exactly the same time.
But it's still late, I guess.
It's late. It's Bob after dark, guys.
It's been a long day of work and teaching, so I will go home and conk out.
There you go. Well, once again, Rabbi, as Bob says, thanks for coming on. I learned so much in this past hour or so, and it's great. We have this kind of a platform to like learn more about others and the myth behind it and all that good stuff. So, Rabbi, thanks again for coming on.
Absolutely. Have a great night, Rabbi.
So I have one closing question, and that is Hammond. Now, I was an assistant rabbi in Indianapolis, but I don't know where Hammond is.
We are on the border of Chicago.
Oh, okay. So is that anywhere close to Hawkins?
I wouldn't say so.
No, isn't that where Stranger Things is based in?
Okay, I wanted to test your
Is Hawkins even a real place in Indiana?
I think
it is not.
Okay. No, but we're I was gonna bring that up to you, but I didn't want to like take that away, you know, be like, hey, I saw you studied in Indianapolis, but I didn't want to like take you back and be like, why is this weirdo looking up my background like that?
that's what a good interviewer should do. Yeah. So I spent a little time in Indianapolis and now I know where Hammond is. So
absolutely. But we call ourselves Chicago up here. It's just all there is to
it. Even though we're really Indiana.
It's Chicago. I'm 3 seconds away from it.
Okay. You know what my senior rabbi liked to say?
What's that?
What's the best thing about Indianapolis? It's only 3 hours from Chicago.
Have a good night, Rabbi. Sweet dreams to you.
Good night.
That was a great interview, Kopanik.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be wrapping up the show here shortly, but I think it's time to spill the beans on some certain stuff.
It's happened.
Okay, I can't share a whole lot right now.
But you're going to share something.
I'm going to share something for the live audience and something in regards to podcasting. Podcast Land is going to, when you hear this, you will see it on the social media because I'm going to be posting it from either Salem, Massachusetts, Boston, or Connecticut. I am going out to the East Coast this Saturday, and I will say I'm not going there for a convention. I am going out there to chase probably the biggest lead I've ever had with Bob After Dark yet. I will share all of the information, or at least the information I can share, I guess you could say legally, this weekend. But this trip there's nothing set in stone. I promise you that. There's no definitive future to it. But I will say this is potentially the big break for the show. And I'm working with some really great people on said project, and I hope to come home with good news. There won't be an episode next week because of it. I will still be out on the East Coast. Maybe if Sam and some guy named Tony Panic, I don't know who that is. Maybe Sam and Tony Panic, when they do their region rush hour next week, maybe I can call from the East Coast and kind of fill them in on what I'm doing.
For sure.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll...
I thought you wanted us to host the night show. Okay.
No, I was going to say I could call in the region rush hour.
Yeah, call
it. There won't be a... So there won't be a Bob After Dark next week because I'll still be on the East Coast working on this project, and I will be back Thursday, it's just not going to pan out right. But guys, I will say that the reason why Bob After Dark has been so weird lately, it's not due to my laziness. It's not due to, it's been due to being busy. There has been a lot of work prepped into this project. The people, the powers that be, as I will say them right now, have so much faith in the brand that me and Count Panic have been working on for 2-3 years now, that this is, it's been a lot of work. And in order for me to produce content every week or every other week, as we've been kind of going back and forth, I will say that if I didn't have the guests that we had and the how we've been splitting up the show, I don't know if I would have had time to put, if I would have had time to pump research into a topic, give the news articles every week. That's why we've been kind of, you've been seeing the episodes have been different lately, and that's okay. I've had a lot of good compliments about the interview stuff lately. Once everything's kind of back to normal, which I don't know what normal is going to be like coming home. I'm going to be completely honest with you, but starting in November, we're going to go back to normal format. We're not going to have any guests. Well, we're probably going to have some guests on the first week of November. That's it's a little different. That one
still be week after week.
It won't be week after week. We'll be back to normal, content. And we'll go from there. Right now I can tell you that the future of Bob After Dark is bright. It is very, very bright. And although Count Panic's not traveling with me this weekend, I will say that if things pan out the way I want them to, Count Panic and me will be taken very good care of. I will say that.
All right, Bob.
This is everything we've ever wanted, right? And this is the best shot we've gotten yet to reach the goal of where we're at. And I wish I could share more with you, but I have to be vague. Yeah. I'll just tell you that there's a project we're working on. I will share more of it this weekend, and I will be sharing more of it on Ghostly Podcast next week. They'll have a little bit more information, and then Region Rush Hour. There are certain things I can't talk about yet, the exact details of the content, but I can tell you what it's based on, and you guys can find that out. The first place is going to post to the Bob After Dark page. And then we're going to talk about it on the major social media. So I'll have something on the Bob After Dark Facebook page first and foremost. Then I'll make sure the Children of the Night Facebook page gets it. And then throughout the weekend, if you're following me on TikTok at Bob After Dark, I think that's how you follow somebody on TikTok, is at something. But Bob After Dark on TikTok, go on there. I'll be having a bunch of videos up there of me and my adventures through the different places we're going. And then at the end, I'll have a big reveal of what the heck I'm actually doing out there. I will say I'm extremely terrified. It's scary. This is definitely a scary process, but I want to make you guys proud, the fans and the people that have been rooting for us this entire time. And I want to make Count Panic proud too.
Proud, Bob. Don't worry about that. But you know what? You don't know unless you try, and you're going out there, you're doing stuff.
Thank you.
I got to be vague too. So
you got to be vague. Yes. And that the one thing I can tell you is that if everything pans out the way I'm anticipating it to, and obviously what I'm hopeful to see happen, is me and Count Panic are going to be taken care of. And that's important.
There you go.
Yep. So stick around, guys. This podcast is coming up is going to be uploaded on Sunday. It'll probably get uploaded even earlier than that, because I'm going to try to get this done Friday before I fly out. But I follow along on social media, guys. I'm going to be posting all my adventures in Salem, and I'm going to be in Boston. My big plan is to go have a beer at Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to Cheers to go have a beer.
That's say Norm.
Norm! So that's my big thing. So follow me along, guys. I'll have lots of social media posts, so stick around for all of that good stuff.
All right.
Do you have any closing words for the evening?
Well, great episode once again. Thank you, Rabbi, for joining us.
Absolutely, Rabbi.
Exciting time for Bob After Dark. And we'll see what's on the horizon here. So, Bob, thank you for another great episode.
Thank you for producing another episode. All right, folks, I just want to wish you sweet dreams. To my mom and dad, I just want to say goodnight to you. And to Tiff, no matter where you are in the world, I just want to wish you the sweetest dreams of them all. Goodnight, everybody. And remember, the two most important rules of Bob After Dark are: not all who wander are lost, and as above, so below. Until next time.
Memoriam Development.